From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Bush administration will have a clear choice to make in Africa. Either it'll be mostly interested in black gold, or it will be mostly interested in black people, who have a very different agenda. It is an agenda of struggling for greater forms of democratic government, for development, and for peace and security.
Today we'll take a look at Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, George W. Bush's picks for National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, and their views on Africa. We'll also look at how Congress dealt a high-power blow to low-power radio stations. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect George W. Bush yesterday named Alcoa Chair Paul O'Neill as his Treasury Secretary. If confirmed by the Senate, O'Neill will assume the cabinet post at a time when some experts are warning of a possible economic downturn. Against the backdrop, O'Neill will try to develop and sell Bush's $1.3 trillion 10-year tax cut proposal and his plan to privatize parts of Social Security. At Alcoa, O'Neill has worked to increase the firm's share of the market through mergers with other aluminum firms and by purchasing state-owned assets from Hungary, Italy, and Spain. Bush also named Texas oil man Don Evans his Commerce Secretary and Veneman as Agriculture Secretary and Mel Martinez as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Meanwhile, the president-elect began talking up his ideas on energy. Bush said yesterday he wants to urge other countries to develop policies aimed at exploiting new sources of oil and natural gas and to work with OPEC to, quote, convince them to open the spigots. For Energy Secretary, Bush is considering Alaska Governor Tony Knowles, who supports drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Finally, Bush held a private meeting with around 30 Christian, Jewish, and Muslim clergy for his plan to establish a White House Office of Faith-Based Action. He declared he wants to begin a dialogue about how government can encourage faith-based programs. During his campaign, he had promised to expand the ability of spiritual organizations to provide services to the poor and argued that government money should go to such groups. The Department of Agriculture announced yesterday final adoption of the first standards that the federal government has ever imposed for the labeling and processing of organic foods. The new standards, which were ordered by Congress and then took the department more than a decade to produce, ban the use of irradiation, biotechnology, and sewer sludge fertilizer for any food labeled organic. Other major provisions of the rules issued yesterday ban synthetic pesticides and fertilizers in the growing of organic food and antibiotics in the meat labeled organic. Chile's Supreme Court yesterday threw out an order to arrest former dictator Augusto Pinochet, dashing a bid to speed him to trial to face charges of murder and kidnapping during his 1973 to 1990 rule. The Dutch parliament has legalized marriage and adoption by gay couples, two bills extending equal rights to same-sex couples, one endorsement by the upper house after clearing the more powerful lower house in September. Although several other countries register same-sex couples and some even call them marriages, the Dutch law goes further by eliminating all references to gender. It also gives all couples equal rights to adopt children after living together for 3 years and approval by a court. And seven high school seniors who say bureaucratic bungling by their schools kept them out of the University of California system sued yesterday for another chance at admission. The students, who were joined in their lawsuit by the ACLU, say they're being unfairly denied a guaranteed UC education. Nearly a sixth of California's 852 public high schools missed an August 31st deadline to submit the transcripts the UC system needed to offer guaranteed admission to the top 4% of each high school's seniors. And last night, ACT UP protesters, that's the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, crashed the Christmas party of Bristol Myers Squibb. We're joined on the phone right now by activist Mark Milano. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here.
Explain why you went to the Christmas party yesterday.
Well, actually, it was kind of a happy accident. We had planned the action for a couple of weeks to protest the price hikes of Videx. Videx, or DDI, is an old Bristol-Myers drug that was paid for and researched by the U.S. government and then licensed to Bristol-Myers back in 1991. It's a drug that has to be chewed, and it's not very, it tastes pretty bad. They came with a new formulation that can be swallowed, so it's easier to take. But they jacked the price up 33%. This is in addition to raising the price close to 60% over the last 9 years. So they pretty much doubled the price of this drug since they first were given it by the federal government. And the real concern was ADAP programs, which provide drugs to people who have no health insurance or Medicaid. They have fixed budgets, and if they're going to add this new formulation of this old drug, they're going to have to cut other drugs that they carry. And we were very angry because Bristol-Myers had promised to give these programs a price break, and then they retracted that promise. So we went to see the CEO, and to our surprise, we walked in on the Bristol-Myers Christmas party with carolers and lots of revelry and that kind of stuff. And we made a mess. We screamed and chanted, dropped the price of Videx, greed equals death. We threw out flyers. Security got extremely upset, and a man named Vito forcibly ejected me, but did read the flyer in the elevator on the way down. So we certainly, I think, threw a wrench in their holiday proceedings, let them know that they're being a Scrooge to lots of people with HIV around the world.
Well, Mark Milano of ACT UP, thanks for being with us, and season's greetings.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Alpha Yaya Diallo singing The Future here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. There's got to be priorities, George W. Bush responded when asked about Africa in the second presidential debate. Africa did not make his short list. The Middle East, Europe, the Far East, and the Americas. Bush presidency portends a return to the blatantly anti-African policies of the Reagan-Bush years, writes Solly Booker, who heads up the Africa Fund. He says those years were characterized by a general disregard for black people and a perception of Africa as a social welfare case. So we gave him a call in Washington to get his perspective on the new appointments of Colin Powell as Secretary of State and Condoleezza Rice as National Security Advisor to President-elect George W. Bush. Again, Solly Booker, who heads up the Africa Fund as well as the American Committee on Africa and the Africa Policy Information Center in Washington, all are merging. We started off by asking him just what Powell and Condoleezza Rice's views are on Africa.
Well, I think it's ironic that the two most powerful positions as far as influencing and charting the course of American foreign policy are concerned are going to go to two loyal African Americans, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. Unfortunately, I don't think either of them will deviate from the general exclusion of Africa from the U.S. global agenda that we're likely to see under a Bush administration. And neither one of them has shown any particular interest in or special knowledge of African affairs, and they have both repeatedly pledged their allegiance to a sort of strong unilateralist view of the use of U.S. power abroad. So it's rather disappointing that for the first time that we have African Americans occupying such powerful positions, that it's not likely to be to the benefit of a new type of U.S. policy toward Africa that's focused more on mutual interests.
What has their experience been, for example, Colin Powell's, with Africa?
Well, to my knowledge, it's been extremely limited, perhaps to commenting on certain developments in Africa as far as they were related to other parts of the world of greater concern to the United States. I'm not aware of any professional activity that he's ever undertaken in Africa. I don't know if he's ever traveled to the continent And certainly in his previous roles in the Bush-Reagan years, he was not concerned about or preoccupied with U.S. policy in Africa.
And Condoleezza Rice?
Condoleezza Rice is what used to be called a Sovietologist, a Russia specialist, and someone who specialized in NATO-Warsaw Pact country relations. And I think she still very much has that same worldview, though times have changed. But she has never had an interest in African affairs. On the few occasions where I've seen her responding to queries from audiences on African issues, she made it clear that she had no particular knowledge of African affairs, and she has no particular interest in trying to increase American attention to Africa. I mean, I think to some degree she has sort of scripted President-elect Bush's responses on these kinds of questions, where he's made it clear that there must be priorities, and Africa, the entire continent, is not one of those priorities, with perhaps the exception of Egypt, because of its obvious relationship to developments in the Middle East.
He did make comments in Africa during the debate.
That's correct. During the second presidential debate, several Africa-related issues came up, including the question of intervention or the lack thereof in Rwanda, the U.S. previous intervention in Somalia, and general issues of conflict resolution. And what he said was that, and I'll quote here, there's got to be priorities. That's what George W. Bush had to say when asked about Africa during the presidential debates. Africa did not make his short list, which consisted of the Middle East, Europe, the Far East, and our own hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere. In other words, virtually every other continent has some part of it that he considers important, but not the entire continent of Africa. He also made it clear that he thought the U.S. had done the right thing, as he put it, by declining to intervene in Rwanda in 1994 to stop or prevent the genocide that President Clinton later apologized for U.S. not only in action, but the U.S. role in preventing the international community through the United Nations from intervening and mounting some multilateral effort to stop that genocide. And I think that that's a critical element in the thinking of Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and the likely foreign policy of a Bush administration. And that is a greater assertion of a U.S. unilateralist view of the world, greater opposition to multilateral approaches to problem solving, whether it's peacekeeping in Africa or fighting the global HIV/AIDS pandemic, or addressing international economic issues such as the unbearable burden of illegitimate debt that African and many other poor countries face.
Hmm. The issue of oil is very big in Africa. You have an oligarchy now at the top. You've got George Bush, an oil man, as well as Dick Cheney, former head of Halliburton, the largest oil services company in the world.
Well, that's right. Oil is the one area where the Bush administration is likely indeed to pay attention to Africa. Dick Cheney, of course, is likely to advise the younger Bush not only on domestic policy but especially on foreign policy. And he made his own views vis-a-vis Africa known when he was a member of Congress, when he voted in a House resolution to oppose releasing Nelson Mandela from prison. That was in 1986. And he also consistently voted against sanctions against South Africa. Since leaving government service, of course, he went to become the CEO of Halliburton Oil Services Corporation. He was very active in the Niger Delta in Nigeria. And during the years of terror under General Sani Abacha, it's a company that hired Nigerian military to fire upon unarmed demonstrators. Condoleezza Rice also has her connections to the oil industry and to Nigeria through the oil industry, as she was a member of the board of Chevron, and I understand there was even an oil tanker named after her that used to ply the waterways in Nigeria.
Well, Chevron, of course, also used the Nigerian military to open fire on unarmed protesters. But what specific case did Halliburton, the oil services company?
It was during the same period that you reported on in your killing and drilling piece. There was similar demonstrations at a site where they had a services contract and engaged Nigerian soldiers for the similar purposes of trying to clear protesters away. Unfortunately, I don't have the name of the town off the tip of my tongue.
Uh-huh. So Condoleezza Rice was on the board of Chevron.
That's right. And so, you know, the Bush administration will have a clear choice to make in Africa. Either it'll be mostly interested in black gold, or it will be mostly interested in black people who have a very different agenda. It is an agenda of struggling for greater forms of democratic government, for development, and for peace and security. And I would argue those are agendas that are mutual with the interests of most Americans as well. But unfortunately, it's going to take quite a lot to struggle to get this Republican-controlled Congress, as well as the new Bush administration, to appreciate the urgency and importance of addressing Africa's priorities, which are also global priorities. I would particularly place emphasis on the issues of responding to the HIV/AIDS pandemic in Africa. Africa is the epicenter of this, indeed, this global threat. And Africa is also the region where there's the greatest concentration of illegitimate debt owed to foreign creditors. These are two priority items for Africans. These are two items that are going to be on the agenda of the next Congress, but not necessarily a priority for the administration. And I think it's going to take the activism of Americans who are concerned, as well as the activism of Africans themselves, to try and change that. And I'm optimistic that that can happen. Certainly when Ronald Reagan was in the White House, the last perhaps great Africa-phobe Republican, there was a great deal of pessimism about what could be accomplished, and indeed that was precisely the same period where American activism secured the passage of the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986 over the veto of a then fairly popular President Ronald Reagan.
On what grounds did Cheney oppose Mandela's release? Was it to do with communism?
To my recollection, it was, yes, it was part of that same old world view that the African National Congress, the freedom movement in South Africa, was a communist movement or a communist-infiltrated movement, that it was a movement that was antithetical to the interests of the United States in that part of the world. In other words, he shared that that old sort of segregationist view, both segregationist in racial and ideological terms. And I don't see anything that would suggest that he's changed his worldview.
We're talking to Sally Booker, who, among other organization, heads the Africa Fund. The issue of peacekeeping in Africa, where does the Bush administration stand?
Well, again, this is an area where the future Bush administration's embrace of unilateralism is likely to hurt Africa. Africa faces a real need for multilateral support for peace and security, rather than this sort of continued expansion of unaccountable bilateral ties that the United States has with a number of African countries. Unfortunately, this administration is likely to ignore many African security crises on the argument that they don't directly threaten U.S. national security interests, because they take this very outdated, what's called realist foreign policy stance. And when they do pay attention to African conflicts, they're likely to try and delegate responsibilities to African peacekeepers, primarily Nigeria. And this it could lead to a sort of dangerous expanding relationship with a privileged partner like Nigeria, but a relationship that is really predicated on their being the Gurkhas or the mercenaries to advance U.S. security interests. And certainly there are U.S. special forces already in Nigeria training a number of battalions now, which began following President Clinton's trip to Nigeria in August. What Africa, in fact, needs is a greater strengthening of the UN peacekeeping system, greater support for UN peacekeeping missions in Africa, such as in Sierra Leone and hopefully in the future in the Congo. And that is not likely to be the Bush administration's initial response.
Do you think that the Clinton administration served Africa any differently when it came to support for the Abacha regime in Nigeria, the Africa NAFTA bill? Mandela castigated Clinton, saying this is a bill for your corporations, not for African countries. What's the difference?
Well, I think during the second term of the Clinton administration, certainly there was greater visibility given to African affairs with the president's two trips, the trips of many cabinet secretaries. But in substantive terms, the Clinton administration's Africa policy was largely symbolic, though not without certain substance. And as you pointed out, the substance in a number of specific cases was in fact damaging to African interests. Certainly, the failure to support the pro-democracy movement in Nigeria, along with the U.S. Refusing to support intervention to stop the genocide in Rwanda, will stand out as two of the worst aspects of U.S.-Africa policy in the 1990s. The whole development of the African Crisis Response Initiative, whereby American troops are training a handful of African battalions from a variety of countries, was itself a negative reaction to the debacle in Somalia, where a number of U.S. Marines were killed, and sort of setting this what's called the Mogadishu line, whereby the assumption is the United States will never directly support peace efforts with military personnel in Africa, and therefore their approach to security in Africa is simply by providing this limited amount of training to African forces instead of providing more appropriately greater support for the UN and a multilateral approach. Clinton, on the economic front, really embraced the congressional agenda, which was the African Growth and Opportunity Act. It wasn't an initiative of the administration itself, but something it embraced in 97 because it needed it for the G7 summit in Denver that particular year. It didn't require any new resources. It didn't address Africa's priority economic issue, which is debt cancellation. And it sought to shift the paradigm away from aid, development assistance, which is really a public investment in promoting development in Africa. It shifted away from aid to focusing on trade, which, of course, is really the focus of U.S. foreign policy in most other parts of the world. And it was able to do it, as it did with many other things, with very high-sounding rhetoric that appealed to a large and, to some degree, diverse audience that wanted to see Africa treated more equally as with other parts of the world. However, in terms of the benefits offered, there's very little in terms of opening up American markets to African goods, and it really embraced the prevailing economic orthodoxy of the Washington Consensus, i.e. imposing the same criteria for eligibility that one finds in the structural adjustment programs of the IMF.
Sally Booker, Director of the Africa Fund, the American Committee on Africa, and the Africa Policy Information Center in Washington, D.C. A website?
www.africapolicy.org.
That's www.africapolicy.org. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Amy.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and just to follow up on that last segment of Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice as the national security team for George W. Bush in a piece in the Los Angeles Times in September looking at the significance of oil money in the campaigns. The Los Angeles Times pointed out that as of June 30th, the RNC had taken in $7.5 million from energy interests, its third largest benefactor after financial services and real estate. Bush raised an additional $1.4 million from the oil and gas industries for his presidential campaign, 17 times the figure that Al Gore did. And as for Condoleezza Rice, the newly named national security advisor, Chevron director for 9 years, helped oversee a drilling, exploration, refining, and retailing company that does business from U.S. to Kazakhstan, from Nigeria to China. She's quoted in the Los Angeles Times piece as saying, "I really love learning about oil." Rice said that her time at Chevron has taught her that energy security is a top foreign policy priority. And in a piece in the Washington Post, it points out that as a board member of Chevron and Charles Schwab Corporations, Rice made a minimum of $70,000 a year plus meeting fees and stock options. As well, proxy statements show she owns about $250,000 of stock in Chevron, which, as we said earlier, named an oil tanker after her. Well, we're going to move on to another issue right now. On Tuesday, as Macau prepared to celebrate the first anniversary of its handover to China, police scuffled with Falun Gong practitioners who protested the Chinese government's crackdown on the group. As Chinese President Jiang Zemin arrived, authorities detained more than 20 adherents of the meditation sect. A year ago, China formally labeled Falun Gong a cult. An estimated 100 million Chinese citizens, including members of the Communist Party, are practitioners. Beginning in December, China intensified its crackdown by demolishing hundreds of churches and temples practicing what they call unauthorized worship along the southeastern coast. Beijing charged that Falun Gong, quote, fully abandoned national pride, threw themselves into the arms of overseas anti-China forces, and were willingly used by international hostile forces as tools to interfere in China's internal affairs. According to the Hong Kong-based Information Center for Human Rights and Democracy, scores of the Falun Gong members arrested have been tortured to death during detention. We're joined right now by Danny Schechter, who is author of a new book called Falun Gong's Challenge to China, Spiritual Practice or Evil Cult. We're also joined in the studio by Li Li, professor of economics at Pace University here in New York City and a practitioner of Falun Gong for 4 years. First of all, let's start off with what Falun Gong is. Professor Li Li.
Falun Gong is a very ancient practice system. Actually, it's a very traditional one. It was passed down the privately generation through generations. Only until the 1992, Mr. Li Hongzhi modified it in order to let more people benefit from this very traditional Chinese practice system. And then since then, it has been popularized in more than 40 countries, including the U.S. And many people here in New York City are practicing Falun Gong. And Falun Gong, basically speaking, is a practice system for body, mind, and spirit. So it's as a practice, it's not a cult, it's not a sect. And I was kind of a little bit uneasy when you talk about, when you mention Falun Gong as a sect. It's just a practice like Tai Chi, you know, you do the slow movements. And it has a philosophy behind that. The philosophy is truthfulness, benevolence, and forbearance. And I believe nobody will associate this principle with evil, anything evil.
Danny Schechter, the news dissector, as you are fondly known, why did you write a book on Falun Gong?
Well, for many, many years, our company Global Vision has been covering human rights stories around the world. We did the Rights and Wrongs human rights television series. I've done a film on Tiananmen Square and the aftermath of what happened in China in 1989. And just by chance, while I was promoting my book, the more you watch, the less you know. One of the people working with me on that was a Falun Gong practitioner, and she told me about it. At first, it didn't sort of register with me. I didn't really know much about it. And then suddenly, on April 25th, 1999, 10,000 to 15,000 people rallied in Beijing outside the leadership compound, appealing to the government to legalize their practice and to stop harassing Falun Gong practitioners. This was the first direct nonviolent activism in China, you know, since 1989. Of course, that caught my attention right away. What was Falun Gong? What is it about? What does it represent? Is it a force, a positive force for change in the world? How does it relate to the whole human rights situation? And so I was intrigued by that and began to pay a lot more attention. In July, the Chinese government banned Falun Gong, calling it an evil cult, denouncing it for promoting superstition. And in the course of that, China began a roundup and a crackdown on Falun Gong practitioners that's grown in intensity since then. In fact, just yesterday, Amnesty International issued a report saying that China has been guilty of appalling human rights abuses against Falun Gong, and an alarming number of followers were dying in police custody, according to this Amnesty report. While China claims it is committed to promoting and protecting human rights, the crackdown on Falun Gong and other so-called heretical groups is being stepped up, and the number of victims is growing daily. It appears many of them died as a result of torture or after force feeding while they were on a hunger strike, according to Amnesty's own report. Now, Amnesty is very well known for scrupulous research. So here you have a situation growing in intensity, people being tortured to death, and nobody knows anything about it. It's not in the press. It gets very little attention. When it is reported in the United States, it tends to be reported the same way it's reported in China, as a cult and a sect. Pejorative language is used to describe it. Very few practitioners likely ever get on the air or are ever interviewed about why they're doing this. And instead, there's been this kind of vicious attack, and accompanied by complicity on the part of the U.S. government and silence by the corporate sector, which is busy doing business in China. And then most recently, my good friend Christopher Hitchens in The Nation magazine devoted a column to slamming Falun Gong on the basis of one interview with a so-called cult buster in Beijing. And Christopher was supposed to be on the show today. One of the things that China accuses Falun Gong of doing is, you know, promoting suicides among its members. None of this has been documented by any third party. So I thought maybe it was suicidal of me to try to debate Christopher Hitchens himself on this issue. But Christopher apparently couldn't make it this morning. I also have a letter in The Nation challenging his column, which appears this week, and he didn't respond to that. So maybe at some point we can discuss this in more detail. But from my perspective, and I'm taking a human rights and journalistic perspective, I'm troubled by three things. A, what's happening to these people, and why the left, why people who are progressive in America don't see the need for more solidarity and more support for people who are being viciously treated. There are 50,000 people that have been detained in China, and many, many more harassed, lost their jobs. And many of these people, this is the irony of all this, are members of the Communist Party. They're not against the government per se. In fact, they're quite apolitical, and they're proud of it in the sense that they say they have no political agenda. And yet, they're being presented as if they're anti-China. China now recently called them counter-revolutionaries, which is almost like what happened in 89, where they characterized the escalation of rhetoric led to characterizing the students as counter-revolutionaries. And we know what happened after that. The tanks rolled into Beijing and people were shot down in the streets. I'm hoping that won't happen. And I'm hoping that people will pay more attention, learn about this. You don't have to be a practitioner or even sympathetic to all of their ideas necessarily to support their right to practice their beliefs, their spiritual practice. And this is what troubles me a great deal about the inattention, first in the major media. I run the mediachannel.org, which is a global website. We've been monitoring coverage of Falun Gong, among other issues worldwide. And what we've seen is this sort of downplaying of this story at the same time that trade with China is increasing. So I think it's and that media companies themselves are becoming involved in China. And we reported a story by a young woman from Associated Press Television, APTV, who basically reported that when she began looking into this issue, not only was did China harass her and eventually throw her out of China, but that she was fired by her own company. So, you know, I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about the lack of analytical coverage. Yes, there have been reports on so many arrested today, so many arrested tomorrow. But basically, there's been a lack of interest. And I wanted to just read, Amy, if I could, a quote, because and this is not from Lee Hung-shir, but I actually brought this for Christopher Hitchens, who's now with us.
No, he is not.
Oh, he's not. Sorry. This is from none other than Karl Marx, okay? And Karl Marx, as you know, the famous quote, opium is the religion is the opium of the people. But actually what Karl Marx wrote, the whole sentence, he says, you know, religious suffering is an expression of real suffering and at the same time a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world. It is the spirit of spiritless conditions. It is the opium of the people. The demand to abandon illusions about our conditions is a demand to abandon conditions which require illusions. So here too, if you look into this, it's more complex than it appears on the surface, just as Falun Gong is. That's why I've written Falun Gong's Challenge to China, a report and a reader published by Akashic Books, and a new film about it as well.
That film wanted to play a very brief excerpt from the leader, Lee Hung-shir, a comment he made about Falun Gong. You are listening to Democracy Now!
The cult charge.
I don't think it should be called as cult. As for the propagation of superstition, is it that all religions like Buddhism, Catholicism, Christianity are all superstitions? The questions I've been addressed have been within the scope of what they've been talking about.
Many real cult leaders.
And that's an excerpt from the Schechter film on Falun Gong. Professor Lili, who is Lee Hung-shir? He's now in the United States?
Yes, he's in the United States. He's the founder, as I just mentioned before, he's the founder of Falun Dafa. He modified the traditional practice system to something that would be suitable for everyday people.
But where does he come from?
He originally comes from the northern eastern part of China.
And who is he? I mean, aside from being the founder, what is his background?
Basically, I would say that I have very little interest in his background, and I do not know what else he's doing except that he's teaching Falun Gong. And the reason I'm not interested, I think most practitioners are not interested, is that we are most interested in his teachings of truthfulness, benevolence, forbearance. And that's the thing we mostly benefit from. And because Falun Gong is not a religion, there's no worship. And so I have no interest in getting to know his personal life.
Danny Schechter, do you know why he's in the United States?
Well, there was a conflict in China. You know, Falun Gong actually was kind of introduced in 1992 in China. He taught it for 2.5 years in China, reaching maybe 20,000 people. And then what began to happen was a tremendous amount of word of mouth spreading Falun Gong. Qigong practices had been outlawed during the Cultural Revolution. They had come back. Even some of the leaders in China were practicing Falun Gong, or they saw Falun Gong. I mean, not Falun Gong, but Qigong, different practices. Li Hung-shir basically developed a sort of synthesis, a new way of understanding Qigong, what he claims a higher level of a cultivation practice where somebody cultivates their own spirit, their own heart, their own understanding, and their own body. This caught on in China dramatically for a couple of reasons that I put forth, which is not put forth by everybody. One, that the transition in China from from socialism to capitalism to the market system, had also brought with it a tremendous amount of corruption, unemployment, inequality, and a lot of problems that people in China were not really used to. And there was a tremendous spiritual void. People responded to this. The hospital system and healthcare system, the same privatization that's taking place here was taking place there, where, you know, if you had a lot of money, you could get very good health care. If you didn't, you'd have to go to hospitals that you wouldn't want to go to. So many people began to practice and see health benefits in all of this, and they felt that this really improved their health and well-being. And as a result, this practice spread like wildfire. The other factor that happened was there was a Chinese attempt to regulate all these Qigong practices, and really the government bureaucracy was sort of raking money off of what all these different masters were doing. Li Hongzhi decided to offer it for free and not to charge for it. And this was something that the other masters got very upset about and were actually quite jealous of. And they appealed to the government to step in and force him to raise his prices, because all the people were going to Falun Gong, not to the other Qigong practices. And this led to a business dispute, which led to a political conflict. And as the Chinese government, particularly Jiang Zemin, the president, after the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, he emerged as a major figure, mobilizing people and promoting himself. And he thought that this crackdown on Falun Gong would be a snap. They would just outlaw it. It would go away. What's actually happened is what's really interesting to people curious about change. And that is that this movement has intensified, and it has resisted using Gandhian methodology. Many people in Falun Gong invoke Martin Luther King. They see this as a movement of nonviolent direct action to defend their rights. And by going to jail, it's not because, as Christopher Hitchens says, they're protest prone or something like that. It's because they're trying to defend their right to practice Falun Gong. And this is something that makes this very interesting, because when you're talking about 100 million people and you're talking about direct action and you're talking about people who are willing to stand up for their beliefs, I think we have to take a look at this and see why this is taking place and what this is about. And this is why, you know, Falun Gong's challenge to China, why I've done a book and a film, and why I'm trying to encourage people to investigate this for themselves, read about it. And in my book, what I did was I created a reader. So there's the Chinese government point of view, there's the Falun Gong point of view, there's viewpoints of a number of third parties, including China specialists, who've written about this in a, you know, kind of critical way.
And the number of people we're talking about having been arrested so far?
Well, they say 50,000 have been detained. Many people are arrested, released.
Naturally, about 100 practitioners have been tortured to death in their custody.
And there are many more. One of the things that China is now doing is throwing people into mental hospitals involuntarily, the idea being to give to the Chinese people the sense that these people are crazy. Therefore, you know, we're putting them away in mental hospitals without their consent. And this is an abuse that's being challenged by prominent psychiatrists in the United States who also challenged this practice when it was used in the Soviet Union of putting so-called dissidents or people into mental hospitals.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Li Li, professor of economics at Pace University in New York City, a practitioner of Falun Gong for 4 years, and Danny Schechter, author of, well, this latest book, Falun Gong's Challenge to China, Spiritual Practice or Evil Cult, as well the documentary on the Falun Gong. And the website that Danny Schechter has developed is www.mediachannel.org. That's www.mediachannel.org. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
They were digging a new foundation in Manhattan, and they discovered a slave cemetery there. May their souls rest easy now that lynching is frowned upon. We've moved on to the electric chair. And I wonder who's gonna be president, Tweedledum or Tweedledummer? And who's gonna have the big blockbuster box office this summer? How about we put up a wall between the houses and the highway, and then you can go your way and I can go my way. Except all the radios agree with all the TVs, and the magazines agree with all the radios, and I keep hearing that same damn song everywhere I go. Maybe I should put a bucket over my head and a marshmallow in each ear and stumble around for another dum-dum week for another humdrum hit song to appear. People used to make records, as in a record of an event, the event of people playing music in a room. Now everything is cross-marketing. It's about sunglasses and shoes or guns and drugs you choose. We got it rehashed, we got it half-assed. We're digging up all the graves and we're spitting on the past, and we can choose between the...
Fuel by Annie DeFranco here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Well, Congress dealt a major blow to low-power community radio stations when they slipped in the ironically named Radio Preservation Act of 2000 into budget legislation that was just passed. By setting new technical standards and repealing those already set by the Federal Communications Commission, the law strips policymaking authority from the FCC and hands it to Congress. The FCC had begun to issue FM licenses to more than 1,000 schools, churches, and other community organizations. Many hoped that the plan would help counter the huge consolidation of the broadcasting industry and bringing a diversity of voices to the airwaves. But the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio joined forces to back a bill which, according to its critics, will effectively eliminate around 80% of low-power licenses. We're joined right now by two of those micro radio pirates, two of those low power radio practitioners. We go to Philadelphia to Petri Dish, a media activist and broadcaster with Prometheus Radio Project, and up to Boston to Steve Provisor, who is founder of Radio Free Alston, which was shut down by the government, now Alston Brighton Free Radio. Let's start with Petri Dish. Can you talk about what exactly happened?
Well, sure. What happened was kind of what a lot of people expected to happen 2 or 3 years ago. There's been a long history of the FCC sort of just being in the pocket of the broadcasting interests. When the idea of low-power radio was brought up, we didn't we didn't think that we would get very far. But what kind of surprised us was that the FCC was actually very, very interested. They really got behind the idea. They had a great chairman, William Kennard, who really sort of threw himself into the issue and saw low-power radio as something that was really important to counter the trends towards media concentration of ownership. But eventually what happened is that the typical politics of money and power just sort of caught up with the whole situation, even though we ran into one agency that sort of treated its role as the guardian of the spectrum in the public interest. Even though we found that agency to be responsive to the schools and community groups and churches that were behind Low Power FM, eventually the politics of money and power and how Washington usually works caught up with us, and what we ended up with was a low power radio service that is been almost completely eviscerated. It's only going to be perhaps 20% of the radio stations that the FCC intended to license will be able to go forward. And those stations, generally speaking, will be the ones that are out in the middle of a cow field somewhere.
Democracy Now! Was out in California for the NAB conference, the National Association of Broadcasters, with lots of low-power FM advocates were protesting the NAB stance. You also had a chance to go into the NPR Board of Directors meeting where you, Petri Dish, as well as other low-power FM advocates had a chance to talk to Kevin Close, and we played that on Democracy Now!, a debate on NPR's position on this. Can you explain how you came to understand NPR was involved with the lobbying? Because at first it was very quiet.
Well, yeah, NPR did take a kind of a backseat role on this for a while, but when it became clear to the National Association of Broadcasters that they really couldn't do this on their own, they were having a hard time convincing Congress people that they should be protected from competition from these new radio stations, NPR started to come to the forefront to start going after some of the Democratic congressmen and senators and create a bipartisan effort to stop low-power radio. And they were enormously successful. Now, NPR has never come clean on this issue. They've been very sort of intellectually dishonest about what their objections are. They claim that they have no problem with of low-power radio, but what when you really look at their objections, they're relatively ludicrous. They don't really make a whole lot of sense. One thing that they try to say is that there are it's just this big mystery how 10 and 100 watt radio stations behave, and how much interference they're going to cause. Now, National Public Radio has hundreds of stations that are technically identical, the same transmitters out of the same boxes, the same brands, the same technical specifications. They're what are known as translator stations, and they're used to boost the signal of the major NPR affiliate. And so there's an enormous record. There's 50 years of regulating the FM broadcast band that went into this rulemaking. And NPR tried to make the claim that it was a big mystery and we really needed more testing. What the call for more testing really was a rather elaborate stalling tactic. They really wanted to get past this commission, this FCC under William Kennard. They wanted to get the decision into the hands of someone that is just more sympathetic to the desires of industry to protect itself from competition, and they've pretty much succeeded in that. Even though there was no real, scientific or technical doubt about what low power radio was going to be, they created the impression that there was technical doubt, and so now we have years and years of testing ahead of us, and low power radio will probably die a relatively quiet death, buried in a report somewhere in the FCC.
Steve Petridish is in Philadelphia, a media activist and broadcaster with Prometheus Radio Project in Boston. Steve Provisor, founder of Radio Free Alston. What does this mean to your work, the defeat of the low-power FM activists in Congress, Steve?
Well, first I want to say hi to Petri out there. Petri. Well, specifically, LPFM would not have affected us here in Boston, as in urban areas, this service would never have resulted in any new stations, because the interference criteria that the FCC proposed, even before this boulderizing took place, was not going to allow for stations in these crowded markets, especially after they protected the translators that Petri mentioned. If they had not done that, there may have been a couple in the greater Boston area, but they did protect them, so there aren't. So for us, it was never specifically going to affect us initially. There is, however, a history, there is a pattern when the FCC does initiate new services, and they see that they don't cause a problem, they don't cause interference, then you can begin after a little while to apply for a waiver of the rules as they were initiated. And in a couple of years, we were hoping that we would be able to take our currently existing community access station, which runs at the enormous power level of 0.1 watt, and get some genuine power.
But it won't be able to happen now.
Yeah, it certainly won't be able to happen.
You know, it's interesting. William Kennard, the first African-American chair of the FCC, was clearly extremely angry about this defeat, saw the plan of low-power FM as a cornerstone of his agenda to promote civil rights issues at the FCC. And he said the legislation, quote, shows the dangers of politicizing spectrum management. In an interview with the New York Times, said, this is a resource that everyone has to share. We can't allow people who have the spectrum, he was referring to NPR and the National Association of Broadcasters, we can't allow people who have the spectrum to use their political clout to shut out voices that don't have the same clout. This highlights the power of incumbency. Companies that have spectrum guard it jealously, and they can use Congress to prevent new voices from having access to the airwaves. I'd like to get a final comment from Alan Korn, who is a lawyer with the National Lawyers Guild Center for Democratic Communications. He's based in San Francisco, on what this means for the future. You've represented a number of low-power FM radio activists.
That's right. We were initially working with Mbana Kantaka.
And we only have a minute.
Okay. I mean, for the future, we're certainly looking into possible legal challenges to this. We're encouraging community groups and churches, schools to apply for these limited broadcast licenses that are still available so that they may have standing to challenge what Congress has done. We believe it may be easier to challenge this congressional action as opposed to the FCC's administrative rulings. So that's one avenue, and certainly we're going to see a lot more micro-radio activists taking to the airwaves because they feel they have no choice anymore. They were told to work through the system, and they basically had the rug pulled out from under them.
And Steve Provisor, you've had your station shut down. What does it mean when the government moves in and shuts down a station? How do they do it?
Well, there's a lot of different ways because they function, as Alan Wendell is, under a kind of
real
own,
fast
their own system of law, and you never know exactly what they're going to do.
Well, we'll leave it at that wait to see if there are new voices on the airwaves from low-power FM stations not sanctioned by the state. That does it for the program. Alan Korn, Petri Dish, and Steve Provisor, thanks for being with us. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Matthew Finch is our engineer. If you'd like to write to us, write to mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. When we read that late-breaking news item yesterday on Democracy Now!, God overrules the Supreme Court on the election, we had so many requests for that news item. We're going to post it at webactive.com on our, if you'd like to listen to the program or just see the script today. That's www.webactive.com. Webactive.com. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
I'm Mark Cooper, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, and this is